All right, so what I want to talk to you this morning about is really that water environment and thinking about things from different perspectives than most humans do. And so here's two beautiful pictures of Puget Sound, right? We all love to go out there and see this. But actually, they're not both Puget Sound. The one on the right is from Chesapeake Bay. And unless you were pretty astute, you might not really be able to notice that, right? They both look like blue water and a pretty place to be. Well, that's because you're looking at it from the surface. But if I showed you this graphic of the same two areas, and what's shown here in the color is the depth of seawater, okay? So these are on the same horizontal scales in terms of vertical extent, in terms of horizontal extent, but a different vertical display. So this goes from 0 to 200 meters here on this scale. So you can see that Chesapeake Bay is really shallow compared to Puget Sound. So Puget Sound goes up to over 200 meters in depth, and Chesapeake Bay, I don't even think gets up to 50 meters. So there's a big difference between these two estuaries, these two bodies of water we call estuaries, where fresh water is meeting oceanic water. And there's some implications from that. So one thing, we'll get to the implications in just a little bit. So why are these two estuaries so different? Well, in order to understand that, we have to invoke the Space Needle. So, you know, I grew up in Washington. I did my undergrad up at Western and then came here for grad school. And so I'm used to being able to tell the weather forecast from looking at Mount Rainier. And the way you do that is if you can't see Mount Rainier, that means it's raining. And the way that you, if you do see Mount Rainier, that means it's going to rain. Okay? So that's how we understand our local weather from looking at the mountains. So understanding the bathymetry or the depth of Puget Sound helps if we think about the Space Needle. So it's 605 feet high, 200 meters high, but it pretty much pales in comparison to the glacier that was here millennia ago, and that is responsible for why Puget Sound is so deep. So as you know, this region is glacially carved, and Puget Sound, which was a tectonic feature, got scoured out by the glacier, and that contributed to why it's so deep. Okay, so we call it fjord light. I guess technically it's not a fjord because the glacier went the wrong way. It retreated to the north instead of going out to the ocean. But in any case, it's deep. And another thing is this orange color here, which denotes what we would call the nearshore environment, is very narrow. If you look at Chesapeake Bay, mostly all of that is the nearshore, whereas in Puget Sound, it's just that strip, okay? So implications for the ecosystem. This is something I was on the initial science working group for the Puget Sound Partnership, and we gave them. It's only this narrow fringe of the nearshore habitat that's available to support some of the key species that use a nearshore habitat. Species like herring and other things that lay their eggs in that nearshore area. So because it's narrow, we really have less leeway for destroying that habitat. So that's why nearshore restoration here is quite a big issue in Puget Sound, simply because our nearshore area is very narrow. So once again, understanding the particulars of the basin is really important to understanding how we should, as humans, be interacting. Okay, another facet of the Puget Sound region being glacially carved is that it has these remnant things called sills, which are the high spots, basically the underwater mountains. So you can see that it's getting to this orangish color on some of these sills. They're certainly usually around 50 meters or so up here in Admiralty Inlet at the entrance to Hood Canal and then down at the Tacoma Narrows. Okay, those sills are really important because when we think of how the water flows, we'll talk about this in a little more detail in a bit, but there's surface water that's scooting out at the surface and deep water coming in at depth. But as this surface flow hits this region of the sill, there's lots of turbulence of the water going over the sill, plus it's hitting this upswing, and you get what's known as reflux. So this is a really key point here, that of all the surface water that's leaving Puget Sound, some of it is coming back. A certain percentage of it is coming back at us. So we need to think about what the implications of this is. And it really has two implications. One is that the biota in Puget Sound have a long residency in Puget Sound because of this kind of, it's coming back at you. If you are an estuarine species and you want to stay in an estuary and you get exported, zoom out to the ocean, that's not very good. But if you've got the ability to keep larvae and juveniles in Puget Sound, we have a high degree of residency here. So Puget Sound is, in fact, one of the most productive estuaries on the West Coast. But the other thing is, if we put nasty stuff into Puget Sound and think, oh, it'll just flush out to the ocean, well, we're only partly right. Some of it does, but some of it stays and comes back. So that's why there's been a lot of concern at eliminating the source as opposed to cleaning it up once it's in the sound. This won't be nearly as effective. Okay, and all of this because of this situation where we have sills that change the hydrography, the circulation. A third thing about Puget Sound, so one, it's deep, two, it has sills. The third thing is that it has very strong influence from climate. Well, there are a few places on the world that don't have an influence from climate, but ours here is particularly strong. And in an estuary, you get what I call the triple whammy. You get a global influence on ocean conditions, and those affect Puget Sound. You get a global influence on watershed conditions, how much snowfall we have, right? And those affect Puget Sound because of the fresh water coming into Puget Sound. And then the local weather is influenced, so how sunny it is, how windy it is. So when we have global climate change, we have to be thinking about how that change, or global climate variability even, how that change is affecting each one of these spheres of influence on Puget Sound. So when we have El Nino, we actually have less precipitation, which makes you think that Puget Sound should be more salty. But we also have dampened upwelling off the coast, which doesn't bring in as much high salinity ocean water. So in fact, we actually have lower salinities typically during El Niños, even though you'd predict based on what most people think about, which is the precipitation. So it's complicated. And the forcing is particularly strong because of the local upwelling along the Pacific coast, which then comes into Puget Sound. And what does local upwelling do? It brings deep water to the surface. Deep water has high nutrients and low oxygen. Huh, sounds like eutrophication, right? So if we have a particularly strong ocean upwelling signal coming into Puget Sound, that means, once again, we have less leeway in Puget Sound to do our own human-caused eutrophication that's adding nutrients and driving oxygen lower. So it's a very complicated system. All right, so implications, climate effects like ENSO, drought, etc., have a strong influence. Variability is strong, so therefore we need to make sure that the ecosystem has things that like resiliency, redundancy, diversity, in order to assure that the ecosystem can adapt to these strong signals. Okay, so those are the implications that we wanted to leave with the partnership in terms of thinking about how we strategize the important things on which to focus. And so, but what I want to leave you with is this statement that Puget Sound's the only fjord-like estuary that has all three of those functions that's also heavily urbanized. Okay, there's other fjord estuaries in the world, but not that have the amount of urbanization that Seattle has. So that doesn't mean that we shouldn't look towards other systems to learn from what people are researching and finding out, but it does mean that we can't exactly use things cookie cutter, and we do need to interpret how these sorts of processes work out in Puget Sound, because it is very unique. So urbanization. Here is a picture of downtown Seattle from the 1800s, and already you see a lot of changes. Some of these things say cut areas, there's one on here that says burnt areas. But if you compare to the present day, you see a big change. And it's pretty impressive what we've done, not only to the watershed, but also to the surf, to the river flow. So anyway, that's a point that doesn't, that people are pretty used to thinking about. But how that affects the functioning of Puget Sound is something that we really need to focus on. Okay, so let's think more about the water and what's below the surface. So we talked a bit about the bathymetry already. So bathymetry meaning the seabed and the morphology of the seabed, so the basin. Okay, but let's talk about this stuff in the middle, which is the water, which is the stuff that people don't see. And so here, I love this graphic from Rick Thompson up at IOS in Canada, because it really shows what oceanographers see in water. Water has structure. It has structure, which we can't see because it just looks like water, but it has a density structure. There's lighter water, there's heavier water. And that's what's shown by the coloring of these layers. Water also has movement, and that's something we probably have a better intuitive feel for because we go out and we see the movement of water. But mostly what we're seeing is the movement due to tides, okay? And what this is showing is the movement due to the estuarine exchange, or what we call estuarine circulation, where the fresh water is coming in at the surface, and because it's lighter, it's scooting out along the top, and seawater is coming in at depth, okay? So we'll delve into this a little bit more. So first of all, let's just back up. I talked to diverse audiences, and only a third of you had any oceanography, so I want to make sure everybody understands what we mean by this structure. So temperature and salinity determine density. So you know the classic oil on top of water, right? The oil's lighter. It doesn't mix with the water. You shake it up, it mixes for a while, and then it restratifies, okay? Stratifying meaning that layering. Well, warm water is less dense than cold water. It's because the molecules are actually spread out. Density is mass per unit volume. So there's simply, in a given volume, there's less mass because there's fewer water molecules because they're spread out. Fresh water is lighter than salty water because salt water has the added salt ions in it, okay? So we've got this warm and fresh over cold and salty. And oftentimes we have a barrier between the two. It's kind of funny because in the open ocean, the salinity is quite constant, so people talk about the thermocline. But in estuaries, there's more variation in the salt than there is in the temperature. So we really should call it the pycnocline, or change in density. But most people say thermocline anyway. So anyway, these two terms just simply mean where is the region where there's a strong gradient between either temperature or density. All right? So less dense, more dense. All right. Now, the density structure in a given body of water, if we went out to West Point or we went over to Hood Canal, we could see different forms of that density structure. And I put the two kind of like extremes up here. So stratified is when we have this two-layer system that we just showed you. Mixed is exactly that. It's a technical term, very well mixed. And so oceanographers refer to a mixed water column. It simply means when it's mixed, okay? Why would it be mixed? Well, it could be mixed because of strong wind. It could be mixed because of turbulence, because the water flowed over either a sill or rocks. You know, up in the San Juan Islands, there's race rocks, and it's all turbulent there. The water column's mixed. Tidal mixing. So any physical force that's stronger than that gradient, that can obliterate that gradient, would be called mixed, okay? So now, as Ann said, I'm a biological oceanographer, so I'm not just going to talk about temperature and salinity. So more things vary than just temperature and salinity, and this is my favorite equation. We all can have our personal favorite equations. And so this is photosynthesis. So this says, in the presence of sunlight and nutrients, carbon dioxide combines with water to make biomass and evolve oxygen. So that's photosynthesis in that direction. That's respiration in the opposite direction. Everything respires. We respire, but so do phytoplankton. So does algae. So does zooplankton, fish, bacteria. Okay? So this equation is going in this direction where there's photosynthetic organisms, and in this direction where there's living, living organisms. And so we tend to have the phytoplankton present up here because we need sunlight. And so what does that do? It draws down the nutrients because they need nutrients, and it evolves oxygen. So typically the surface waters will have lots of oxygen, not only for the photosynthesis, but also because it's in contact with the air, so it equilibrates. But it will tend to have lower nutrients because the phytoplankton have used them up. Down here, phytoplankton will sink, but they don't accumulate because there's no light for photosynthesis, so their population just doesn't accumulate. So there tends to be no or few phytoplankton. And what we have is a lot of nutrients for two reasons. One, because no cells are taking them up, so there's no withdrawal. But also because as the cells sink, they get broken down by the bacteria. And in this equation going the opposite way, the nutrients that were incorporated into the biomass are released. So we have lots of nutrients down there. But it consumes oxygen, right? So if we have a stratified water column, we have this two-layer sort of situation where we have low nutrients, high oxygen, low oxygen. All right? So now let's think about Hood Canal and Puget Sound. After all, that was in my title. So here, Puget Sound is this main basin we call here. So we're somewhere over here. There's Hood Canal, the big long hook sort of thing. And you'd think that they'd be pretty similar. Well, if we look at them in the way an oceanographer looks at them, which is to take instruments and let them go through the, what we call the water column, so down with depth. And this is done with a buoy, this orca buoy up here. It has all these sensors, and it's profiling several times a day. But you could go out on a boat and have one of these devices. We call them CTDs for conductivity, temperature, and depth. But they have all sorts of sensors, and you can drop those down and see what the characteristics of the water is. Well, here, this happens to be from November of 2006, but I like this profile for a reason that I'll explain. First of all, this is near Admiralty Inlet, so in Puget Sound, and the profiles are straight up and down, so what we would call well-mixed. Over here within Hood Canal, even in November, we actually have some stratification. Notice it's actually colder at the surface, which you'd think, oh, that's actually more dense. But because there's a salinity gradient, there was some fresh water input from rivers in Hood Canal, that density gradient, which is shown here, I'm sorry, this says sigma T, that actually means density. I thought I corrected that in this one. So that's that little bit of cushion of a density gradient there right up at the surface caused because we've got some strong salinity gradient. And now we would predict that oxygen and chlorophyll might look different in these two regions at this point in time. So what would we predict? We'd predict in this well-mixed water column that the oxygen and the chlorophyll would be just that, very well mixed. The cells can't get growing because as soon as they start to grow with the sunlight, they're sent down to where it's deep and there's no sunlight for them. Over here, we might predict that a population could get growing there at the surface. Okay? And of course, you never say you'd predict something unless I'm going to show you that. But you would predict it based on the concepts that I just explained to you earlier. And sure enough, so the light blue here is oxygen, and it's a little faded out, but hopefully you can see it. In our well-mixed water column, everything is just straight up and down. This is a concentration, and this is expressed as a percentage of the saturation. Don't worry about it. It's just two different ways of telling us how much oxygen is in there. And sure enough, at the surface, we see this increase over in Hood Canal of oxygen at the surface. Well, why is it increasing there? Well, look at all of this green stuff here. This is the photosynthetic molecule chlorophyll. Chlorophyll is the molecule that's in all photosynthetic plants and algae that allows photosynthesis. And we use it out in marine water columns to detect where the phytoplankton are, the unicellular algae, the diatoms, dinoflagellates. Okay, and so even here in November, this was associated with some sunny days back in 2006. It's been a long time. We had some growth of the phytoplankton, as you can tell from the chlorophyll. And they were able to expand their population because of this density gradient. prevented them from getting washed down here, okay? And so that's why we have this population. That's why we can see this expression of the oxygen. They're photosynthesizing. They're releasing oxygen. And so we see that increase. Also, you can see that down once you get underneath this surface layer, this oxygen is less than what you see over here in the main basin. And that's the whole situation with Hood Canal, is that because it's very productive, you're producing a lot of phytoplankton up here that are producing oxygen. When they sink and decompose, bacterial respiration is consuming oxygen to break down that organic material. Okay, so that drives this oxygen low. And in November, it's not so bad, but you've heard of the fish kills there. Okay, we'll get to that in a little bit, I hope. All right, so that's the structure of water. And oceanographers, you know, that's the first thing they want to do is get their instruments in the water so they can see the readouts on those sensors, and they can say, oh, this water column has stratification. Oh, this water column's well mixed. And then you can interpret all sorts of things like the biology and the chemistry from that. Okay, so structure. Now let's talk about water movement. So mostly what you think of when you think of water movement are the tides, right? We all are aware of high tide, low tide, and tidal currents, and they can be quite strong. But the important thing about the tides is they go out and they come back in, and then they go out and they come back in, right? So the net exchange is actually really nothing. So that water, if all you had was tides, is basically staying in place but going in and out. Okay, so it's important, because if we are relying on the tides to cause the pollutants to exit Puget Sound, we're not going to get very far. But that's not the only movement of water in Puget Sound. There's what we call net circulation. And so this is what was depicted in Rick Thompson's little picture that I showed you earlier. And that's this density-driven circulation. It's density-driven because it starts here with freshwater input. So the river, as you know, has collected freshwater from the watershed. There's a hydrostatic pressure coming in, and the river is flowing out. As it does that, it entrains seawater from below. And as it's going out, it's pulling some of that seawater with it. It mixes, right? So this isn't going to stay entirely fresh. It's going to mix with the seawater. And so it's pulling that and exporting that out to the ocean. Well, we can't export all of our seawater, so there has to be a return flow. And that's what we get coming in from the side here, this incoming salt water. So this is that classic estuarine circulation that I showed you earlier, just another picture of it. But it's to also show that when we have a really deep water column, as this current is coming in here, slowly, slowly, there's an upwelling of the deep water as more of this comes in. So it's just this constant flow of outwards at the surface, inwards at the bottom, and a very slow up as it fills in. Okay, so that's net circulation. Now, think about how climate change is going to affect this. This is a picture from Phil Mote talking about temperature trends and precipitation trends. Now, as I told you, the freshwater input from precipitation isn't the strongest signal controlling salinity like during an El Nino, but on the other hand, it's going to have a big message in terms of what that river flow is and how that affects the circulation in Puget Sound. So these are things that are, you know, just now being really addressed and studied to see what effects these might have. And how do we study these with quantitative computer models, because we're trying to project into the future, so you can't really demonstrate this out in the field. So I and Anne and others have been involved in something called the Puget Sound Regional Synthesis Model, or PRISM, and it's a series of models. You can't read it too well here. Cliff Mass has an atmospheric model, several people working on this watershed model, oceanographers working on the marine model, and urban ecology, and other models that are giving input to each other so that we can build what's known as a virtual Puget Sound. Okay, so this is the vision for PRISM and what people are working on. I've been working on systems that are really using the marine model as fed by the watershed and as influenced by the climate. So here's a picture of that marine model. This is for Puget Sound. So let me just walk you through this. So this is depth on this axis. This is horizontal distance. And so this is that red line going down Puget Sound. And so you're looking at it from the side. So this is the seabed. There's the sill at Admiralty Inlet. And then it gets deeper. Okay, so Seattle, we're about right here. And each one of these is a different variable. So this is salinity, phytoplankton, oxygen, and nitrogen. And there's the scale bar, but basically red is always high. So high salinity waters down here at depth, you can see that estuarine circulation. You can see the fresh water up here at the surface. You can see this oceanic water pushing its way in. You can see this is stepping through time here, so phytoplankton. You can start to see phytoplankton blooms here as we get on into summer. You can see how the Admiralty Inlet sill causes them, the turbulence causes them to mix down, okay? And that would be that reflux then that's going to come back in. You can see lower oxygen down deep, higher oxygen at the surface. There's the nitrogen coming in from the ocean. So this is a really powerful tool that we've been using. Mitsuhiro Kawase is the lead modeler on this oceanographic model down at Oceanography. And so we've been using this model or ones like it to look at processes. So then what you can do is you can turn the river off and see what happens, or you can cause the river to have 50% less flow, or you can change the ocean boundary and see what happens, okay? So this is an enormous tool. So with my remaining time, and I want to leave some good time for questions, I want to talk about Hood Canal and what we're doing there. So Hood Canal is long, narrow, deep. That stratification that I showed you is consistent. You see stratification throughout the year. It's persistent. That was even November, and we still had some stratification due to the salinity. Okay. It's naturally productive because cells need that stratification in order to grow. If they're always being washed down to where there's no light, they can't accumulate. So you've got natural productivity, not only in the phytoplankton, but also in fish and other species that depend on that base of the food web, because, one, there's a lot to eat, but two, it's that natural retentiveness. There's a sill right here in Hood Canal, so a lot of the things stay in Hood Canal. Slow to flush, just because of the physics of being long, narrow, and very deep, the time it takes for a water molecule to come into Hood Canal, raise up, and exit is much longer than it is, let's say, in the main basin. That process takes months to a year time scale, and in the main basin it takes weeks to month time scale, okay? That's what oceanographers call a residence time. Residence time is very long in Hood Canal, still at the entrance. Okay, so all of those things would combine to having deep waters that are low in oxygen. There's lots of organic material. We're not flushing it very quickly. We're retaining the water in there. And so sure enough, these are data on a calendar here from January to December. And this is concentration of oxygen on this axis here. This is the average deep oxygen in the 1950s and 60s, okay? And so you see there's a lot of variability. The years with the lines are 1954 and 1966, just when they had data that was consistent enough resolution that you can draw a line through it. But it helps you to see the annual trend. So we have some low values here in the late summer. This concentration is 4 milligrams per liter. Once things get below 5 milligrams per liter, some fish can start to avoid that. Once it gets below 2 milligrams per liter, then you can really start to have some real stress on organisms. We call that hypoxia, and that can be deleterious. So 2's down here, we don't see anything, but keep in mind this is average, right, of the water column below 20 meters, so we chopped off that top stuff. All right, so what's the fuss? Well, what we were seeing in the 90s and 2000s is concentrations much below the historical average, and some getting quite close to this hypoxia, where the average water column is hypoxic. This line happens to be from 2004, and I haven't updated it, but 2006 was also very low. You can see the updated version on the website, and I'll mention the website in just a bit. So that's what really led to the study. No, let me correct that. That's what led to my study. What led to the attention, the public attention, is that several fish kills were observed. And that was really what galvanized the local community, the state, Congressman Dick's office, and the scientists to say, hey, we really need to study this. So what could affect this oxygen? What could be causing it? Well, maybe we're changing either the oxygen that's coming into Hood Canal or the density of the seawater, so therefore how quickly we're going to flush things. Maybe we're changing the river input. We know we've dammed the Skokomish River for power generation. That would also affect the flushing, but also that stratification, that layering. And it's funny because these actually would go in opposite directions. More flushing would tend to give you higher oxygen if you're bringing in new water, but stronger stratification would cause you to have more of an oxygen debt at down deep. So that was interesting. Or it also could be the change in organic biomass or production because we've got more nutrient or because we've got more sunlight. So you can see back in the late 90s, early 2000s, when we started to say, hey, something's really different here in Hood Canal. And when the policymakers came to you and said, well, what is it? What's wrong? You know, is it septic tanks? Is it climate change? Is it changes in the river management? Is it changes in the ocean due to climate change or just natural variability? You can see that we kind of went, don't know. And when you started to research each of these, you could find circumstantial evidence that would help you say, yeah, there have been changes to the river, there have been changes in the open ocean. And so which one of these is something that was tipping things over the top? So we said, we felt it was wise to have a research strategy to evaluate the loading, to better constrain flushing, to evaluate climate and ocean effects, and better understand biota sensitivities so that one could advise the decision makers in what to do. We don't want to tell them, oh, yes, it's the septics, so they spend millions and zillions of dollars on whatever it would take to get septics changed over to sewers, and then, in fact, that has that doesn't do anything for the oxygen situation. So we're using computer modeling. This is the HCDOP Integrated Assessment and Modeling Study. This is our website where you'll find the data for the those profiling moorings, those orca buoys, the updated inventory of oxygen. So it's really easy. In fact, if you just Google Hood Canal oxygen, you'll get there. But it's easy to find. And we're just in the third year of this study, and we'll be releasing our recommendations this spring. So let me just say a few more words about Hood Canal and what we're finding out, and then I'll open it up to questions. So if you look at Hood Canal and ask the question, where is the oxygen the lowest? This is the map that you'd find on average. So low oxygen is indicated by red. Here, red is always bad, right? So here, low oxygen is bad, and so we see that the chronic areas of hypoxia are down in the southern reaches, and that sort of makes sense. This is better flushed by the incoming ocean water, and as that ocean water moves and makes its journey all the way south, there's simply more respiration going on in it, right? So it's kind of like a dialysis tube in that sense. So this is the pattern that you see. But it was very interesting because in September of 06, we had a very major fish kill reports of dead fish all along the area shown here in red, okay, by that red circle. And so it wasn't in this hook part, Lynch Cove of Hood Canal. It was really along the main stem of Hood Canal and mostly on the western shore, okay? So that was sort of interesting. And so what caused that fish kill. Well, here is oxygen data from that profiling mooring. Okay, so this, it says pressure, but it's the same thing as depth on this axis going from the surface to 100 meters. And it's time going in the month of September from the 7th to the 20th. The fish kill was the 16th, 17th of September. And what you see is this low oxygen. Here, low oxygen is purple, so it's a little inconsistent, but different people have different ways of picking their colors. So this purple water, which is the very low oxygen, you can see that all throughout the summer it's kind of getting shallower and shallower. What that is the ocean water coming in. Remember that slow upwelling we talked about. That's what's going on. We started out with low oxygen way back in the early part of the year being down low, and over the course of summer that minimum gets kind of pushed up. But then you see these little poke outs or outcropping of that low oxygen water to the surface. And that actually was consistent with the wind. Okay, here's the wind record. So this is, now when we say upwelling favorable, I don't mean outer coast upwelling. I mean the upwelling right here in Hood Canal. So what happens is when the wind comes from the south, it pushes that surface water to the north. It advects that water to the north, and deep water rises up. Okay, and that's exactly what happens here when we have these southerly winds from the south, wind bursts, and it pushed that low oxygen water to the surface. Okay, and you may be sitting there going like, I'm not really sure if I'm convinced with that. Yeah, it lines up okay, but is that really what caused this fish kill? So the modeler, Mitsuhiro Kawase, ran the model with and without winds and compared where the surface salinity was the most different, and that's red color here, meaning that this red area is where you would get that low oxygen water coming all the way up to the surface. And sure enough, it's right where the dead fish were found. So what happened is you had low oxygen down around 20 meters for most of September, and then during that fish kill event, when we had those strong wind bursts, it outcropped to the surface, and the fish, if they just could have dove down through it, would have been okay, but that's not something that a fish necessarily knows to do, and so they were caught up there where the oxygen was very low, and they died. So we've then subsequently looked at the other fish kill events and found that they're associated with, you got to have low oxygen to begin with, these southerly wind bursts, and the gradient, the density gradient that allows you to push through all the way up to the surface. So that's been a consistent thing that we've found, but we've always had southerly wind, right? We've always had density stratification. So what's different? Well, it's how low the oxygen is, okay? If you bring oxygen that's 3 milligrams per liter to the surface, fish can withstand that. But if you're bringing oxygen that's 1 or less than 1 milligram to the surface, fish can't. So this was really helpful in helping us understand the dynamics of the fish kill, but it didn't answer our ultimate question, which is why is the oxygen getting lower to begin with, okay? And that's the part we're still working on. And one of the things that we know is important in that is the role of nutrients. And a lot of people just wanted to blame septics right off the bat. But there's a lot of other things involved in this. So real quickly, what this is showing is how much primary production or production of carbon per volume and time that you get at a certain depth in Hood Canal under ambient conditions or when you spike it with nutrients. So these are classic what people call primary productivity experiments. You use a radioactive isotope to label the photosynthetic reaction, and you can measure after 24 hours how much photosynthesis went on. And you do that in a bottle of water that's just the ambient seawater, and you do that in a bottle of water where you add nitrogen. If I showed you data from the main basin of Puget Sound, Admiralty Inlet, the blue and the red line would be on top of each other. There wouldn't be that nutrient addition effect. In Hood Canal, you see a very strong enhancement in the amount of carbon you produce when you give it more nitrogen. This is telling us that Hood Canal is nitrogen limited. Okay? And so we can make more production by adding nitrogen. And people think, well, that's good. More production is a good thing, right? Well, but think about it. Follow it through. either that production sinks out and is remineralized and the respired, that respiration causes low oxygen, or it goes into the food web and those organisms are more plentiful, there's more respiration. So if you produce carbon, you're going to oxidize carbon somewhere down the line. So it all comes down to there's an increased carbon debt in the deep waters if you produce more oxygen. Okay, or excuse me, if you produce more carbon. This is a picture of some other data from the orca buoy showing the measurement of nitrate in seawater, and you can see when you get into the shallow water, it basically goes off scale to zero. So we know now that Hood Canal is nitrogen starved for portions of the year. This is showing us where the chlorophyll hangs out. It's not up here where there's plenty of light because there's no nutrients. It's down here where there's just enough light and just enough nutrients. Okay, so you can think that if humans are adding nitrogen, we could definitely be changing how much carbon is produced, and that this could definitely be contributing to the oxygen problem. But what we want to do is be able to, this just shows the annual cycle. What we want to do is show whether this is significant compared to the marine water supply of nitrogen. And so what this is showing you is the marine supply that comes in, but it goes back out. And if I click this a few more times, the water, this under this little green line is coming in. The water above the green line is going out. And now if I color code it so that you can see where the picnic line is, this is salinity, you can see that a lot of the nutrients are going out below where that stratification is. So even though the seawater is bringing in a lot of nutrients, it's not actually fertilizing the phytoplankton. So this could mean that the human impacts actually are more significant. And that's work in progress. I'm not going to tell you the answer because we don't know it yet, but that's what we're working on. So I'm going to stop there and just let these little things flash up and ask for questions. Any questions? Some, yes.
Dan, on that slide that was the low oxygen slide, the blue line was the average from 50 to 60, you said, a two-decadal period of time?
The blue line actually were all of the data that were blue were from the 50s and 60s. And in two particular years, they had monthly resolution, so you could actually draw a line. In the other years, it was just sort of, you know, this month, that month, and you couldn't actually draw a line through it.
So the third line, the red,
yes.
Is that over a time frame which matches those decadal averages?
No.
I'm looking at the just basic nature of an average.
Yeah, no. None of those were averages. Anytime there was a line, it was actually connecting monthly observations. And unfortunately, we only had two blue years and one red year where we had monthly observations. But if you go online to the website, you'll see all of the data individually color-coded. And then I actually do have a slide I didn't show here, which shows the average of all of the blue dots and all of the red dots, and the 95% confidence intervals don't overlap at certain times of the year. Yeah. Another question? Yes.
I've heard that the restoration attempts in Chesapeake estuary have been largely unsuccessful. And I know last quarter we had Phil Lovell's house here who was talking about the chances we have to restore the Puget Sound. And I'm just wondering if you made any comments about comparing, there apparently haven't been very many successful restoration efforts on the estuary around the world. Is there a chance that we have better outcomes here?
I think so. You know, I'm not well versed on the Chesapeake and what really went wrong for their system in terms of their attention to it. One thing that I do know is that the reason our study is called Integrated Assessment and Modeling is that we're really coupling the observations to the modeling. And I know in the Chesapeake that wasn't done as to a successful degree. And so there were times when people are saying, yeah, but the model doesn't even come close to showing what the situation is. And so we've been very strident about making sure that the model can recreate the observational data. Observationalists and model lawyers are two kind of different types of people, and sometimes they don't hang out much together. So we've really integrated those two things a lot. So I think that we have that going for us. You know, I guess in the Pacific Northwest we tend to get less federal money, and I think that makes us stronger and leaner and meaner. I just hope that we're going to have a more focused, targeted approach to the situation out here. Time will tell. Not changes in what? What we've, and let me just back up. She said that it's, it looks like I'm leaning towards nutrients, and it's true that that's the slides I showed you, just because mostly that's what people care about. One thing that we're finding about nutrients is it may not just be the septics, but also the alder trees contribute a lot of nutrients to the watershed, and that has changed over the years. But then, in addition to nutrients, no, we have not ruled out other things like changes in ocean as well as changes in the river input. What Mitsuhiro did see is that when he changed the boundary salinity that, and then changed the river input, that changes in the boundary salinity had a stronger impact on the residence time of Hood Canal than changes in the river did. But what he's running right now is how that affects the stratification and then how that ultimately affects the oxygen. So no, that's still very much work in progress. What I do want you to take away is that we can't rule out the human input of nitrogen yet, but we will be commenting on how important that is compared to other things and also the source of that, because septics may not be the king kahuna.
Let's thank Dr. Newton for a fabulous